So today marks the end of the book of Judges for us, and we're going to move fairly rapidly through Judges chapters 20 and 21, as it is mostly a self-explanatory account, a historical account of perhaps the worst atrocity committed by Hebrews that's recorded in the Bible. I mean, our next study, if you're going to go in order, that you ought to read is the book of Ruth, because the book of Ruth comes immediately after the period of Judges. Now, last week, we studied the gut-wrenching story of a Levite man and his unnamed concubine who live in the hill country of Ephraim. And the time frame is perhaps 20 years more or less after Joshua died. The couple got into some type of a serious argument that led to the woman leaving her husband, going home to her father that lived in Bethlehem. And after the Levite thought it over, he decided that she was worth winning back. So he journeyed the substantial distance from his home to retrieve her if she was willing to come back. She was. There was reconciliation, and so they, along with a servant that the Levite had brought along with him for a traveling companion, they began their journey home, and they stopped the first evening in the city of Gibeah. Now, Gibeah was a tribal territory that belonged to Benjamin, and the Levite had the option of stopping a couple of hours earlier as they passed near Jebus, later called Jerusalem. But because in that area, Jebus was still controlled by one of the many Canaanite peoples, he decided to keep going a little bit further so they could overnight among fellow Hebrews. And as it turned out, that was a big mistake. After arriving at the city of Gibeah, and no Benjamite would offer the customary hospitality that was actually a sacred duty of the residents more than it was a nicety. By refusing to offer hospitality, an old man that was sojourning for a little while in Gibeah noticed this threesome. So he offered him his home as a safe place for them to stay. No sooner had they gone inside did a crowd of worthless men gather and demand that this old man send out his house guest, a Levite man, so they could have homosexual sex with him. The old man was in an impossible position, as he didn't have the means to defend himself or his host from these men, as he was duty-bound to do, according to Middle Eastern custom. So, in an eerie reminder of Lot and the city of Sodom, he offered to send out his own unmarried daughter, as well as the Levite's concubine, for them to have their way with. And while the old man and the Levite huddled inside that man's home in fear, all night long the Benjamite men of Gibeah raped and otherwise tortured the concubine until later, when they were through with her, she crawled back and died outside the old man's doorway. The Levite packed her body onto one of two donkeys he had brought with him from the hills of Ephraim and took her back to his home in Ephraim. But rather than giving her an honorable burial, in his outrage and anger, he shamefully cut her body up into 12 pieces and sent one piece to each of the 12 tribes as a message to ask Israel what they intended to do about such a horror that has happened to this woman and to him. And at the crux of it all was, what would Israel do about a brethren tribe Benjamin, which has brought disgrace upon the entire Israelite nation and has just spiraled out of control? The answer wasn't long in coming. That is what we're about to read now. To best understand the response of Israel and what was going to happen next, we're going to read all of chapters 20 and 21 consecutively without stopping. So, open up your Bibles to Judges chapter 20. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 294. 294. Judges chapter 20, we're going to read all of chapter 20, and we're going to go right into chapter 21, right to the end of this book. All the people of Israel came out, from Dan to Beersheba, including Gilead. The community assembled with one accord before Adonai at Mizpah. The leaders of all the tribes of Israel presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 foot soldiers armed with swords. Now the people of Benjamin heard that the people of Israel had gone up to Mizpah, and the people of Israel said, "Tell us, how was this crime committed?" The Levite, the husband of the murdered woman, answered, "I came to Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin, I and my concubine, to stay the night. And the men in Gibeah attacked me and surrounded the house I was staying in at night. They wanted to kill me, but instead they raped my concubine to death. I took my concubine's body, cut it into pieces, and sent them throughout all the territories belonging to Israel, because they committed a shockingly obscene and degrading crime in Israel. Look, you are all people of Israel, so discuss what to do and give your advice here and now." All the people stood up in agreement and said, "None of us will go home to his tent or his house. What we will do now to Gibeah is this: we'll draw lots. We'll take 10 men out of each 100 throughout all the tribes of Israel, and 100 out of 1,000, and 1,000 out of 10,000 to collect food for the others. And when they come to Gibeah of Benjamin, they will avenge the crime that was committed." So all the men of Israel joined together in complete agreement and assembled to attack the city. Now the tribes of Israel sent men throughout all the tribe of Benjamin with this message: "What is this crime committed by some of your people? Turn over these good-for-nothings who are in Gibeah at once, so we can execute them and rid Israel of such evil." But the people of Benjamin refused to obey the order of their kinsmen, the people of Israel. Instead, the people of Benjamin gathered themselves together from their cities and went to Gibeah to fight the people of Israel. On that day, there were 26,000 men from Benjamin armed with swords, besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who numbered 700 specially chosen men. All of these 700 specifically picked men were left-handed, and every one could sling a stone at a hair and not miss. The army of Israel, apart from Benjamin, numbered 400,000 men with swords. They were all experienced soldiers. The army of Israel began by going up to Beit El, where they asked God, "Who should go up first to attack the army of Benjamin?" Adonai said, "Judah first." So the army of Israel got up in the morning and set up their camp near Gibeah. Then the army of Israel went out to attack Benjamin and set up their battle line in front of Gibeah. But the army of Benjamin came out of Gibeah and slaughtered the army of Israel. On that day, 22,000 men fell. The people, the men of Israel, restored their morale and again positioned themselves for battle where they had been the first day. Then the army of Israel went up and cried before Adonai until evening. They asked Adonai, "Should we attack our kinsmen, the people of Benjamin, again?" And Adonai answered, "Attack them." So the army of Israel went out to attack the army of Benjamin the second day. But Benjamin went out against the men from Gibeah the second day and slaughtered the army of Israel. 18,000 men armed with swords fell. Then the whole army of Israel, all the people, went up to Beit El and cried and sat there in the presence of Adonai. And they fasted that day until evening, offered burnt offerings and peace offerings to Adonai, asked Adonai what to do. The ark for the covenant of God was there at that time. And Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, stood before it at that time. They asked, "Should we still go out to battle again against our kinsmen, the people of Benjamin, or should we stop?" And Adonai answered, "Attack, because tomorrow I will hand them over to you." Israel hid some men around Gibeah. And on the third day, Israel attacked the army of Benjamin and took a position against Gibeah as they had the other times. Again, the army of Benjamin went out against the people. Lured away from the city, they began attacking and killing some of the people as they had the other times. They killed about 30 men of Israel in the countryside and on the roads, one of which goes up to Beit El, the other to Gibeah. The army of Benjamin said, "They're defeated, just as before." But the army of Israel said, "Let's run off and draw them away from the city onto the roads." All the men of Israel left their places and took up a battle position at Baal Tamar, while the other Israel men burst out of their hiding places at Maareh Gebah. 10,000 men chosen out of all of Israel came over to attack Gibeah, and the combat was intense. But the army of Benjamin didn't know that they were about to be defeated. For Adonai routed Benjamin in Israel's presence. That day, the army of Israel destroyed 25,100 men of Benjamin, all of whom carried swords, and the people of Benjamin realized that they had been beaten. The men of Israel, trusting the ones that had put in place to ambush Benjamin, gave ground to the men of Benjamin, and then the men who had been lying in wait rushed in on Gibeah, drew their swords, and destroyed the city. The army of Israel and the ambushers had agreed that as a signal, they would make a huge cloud of smoke rise from the city, at which time the men of Israel would turn back. When this happened, Benjamin began to attack. They killed about 30 of Israel's men and said, "Clearly, we're defeating them again as in the first battle." But when the smoke signal began rising from the city, the men of Benjamin looked behind them and saw the whole city going up to the sky in smoke. Then as the men of Israel reversed direction, those of Benjamin were overcome with terror. And when they saw that disaster had come upon them, they turned their backs on the men of Israel and they made for the road to the desert. But the battle followed them, and those who came out of the city destroyed them from the rear. They surrounded the men of Benjamin. They chased them, and they trampled them down across from Gibeah on the east. 18,000 men of Benjamin fell, all of them experienced soldiers. They turned. They fled towards the desert to the rock of Rimmon. 5,000 of them were killed on the roads. They followed them to Gidom. They killed another 2,000. Thus, the total number from Benjamin who fell that day was 25,000 experienced sword-bearing soldiers. But 600 turned, and they fled towards the desert to the rock of Rimmon, and they lived there for 4 months. The men of Israel turned back on the people of Benjamin and killed them with the sword, the entire city, the cattle, everything they found. Moreover, they set on fire all the cities they conquered. 21. The men of Israel had sworn in Mizpah that none of them would let his daughter marry a man from Benjamin. The people came to Beit El and stayed there before God till evening, crying out and weeping. And they said, God Adonai, why has this come about in Israel? Why should there be today in Israel one tribe missing? The next day, the people got up early. They built an altar, offered burnt offerings and peace offerings, and the people of Israel asked, "Who among the tribes of Israel did not come up to assemble before Adonai?" For they had made a great oath to put to death whoever didn't come up to Adonai at Mizpah. The people of Israel became sorry for Benjamin, their brother. And they said, "Today one tribe has been cut off from Israel. How are we going to obtain wives for those who remain alive, since we've sworn by Adonai that we won't let our daughters marry them?" Then they asked, "Who from the tribes of Israel had not come up to Adonai at Mizpah and found that none had come from Yavesh Gilead to the camp where the assembly was? Since when the people were counted, none of the inhabitants of Yavesh Gilead were found there." So the gathering sent 12,000 warriors there and ordered them, "Go and put the people who live in Yavesh Gilead to death with the sword, including women and children. Completely destroy every man and every woman who has had sex with a man." Among the inhabitants of Yavesh Gilead, they found 400 young virgins who had not known a man by lying with him, and they brought them to the camp of Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. Then the whole gathering sent a message proclaiming peace to the people of Benjamin who were at the Rock of Rimmon. So Benjamin returned at that time, and the people of Israel gave them the women that they had kept alive of the women from Jabesh Gilead, but there wasn't enough for them. The people were still sorry for Benjamin because Adonai had made a division among the tribes of Israel. The leaders of the assembly asked, "What are we to do for those who still don't have wives, inasmuch as all the women of Benjamin have been killed?" And they said, "There has to be a way to help the survivors preserve Benjamin's inheritance so that a tribe will not be eliminated from Israel. Yet we can't give them our daughters as wives, for the people of Israel had sworn, 'Cursed be whoever gives a wife to Benjamin.'" Then they said, "Look, each year there's a festival in honor of Adonai in Shiloh, north of Bethel, on the east side of the road that goes up from Bethel to Shechem and south of Lebanah. They ordered the men of Benjamin, 'Go, hide in the vineyards and keep watch. And if the girls of Shiloh come out to do their dances, then come out of the vineyards and each of you catch for yourself a wife from the Shiloh girls and go on to the land of Benjamin. And when their fathers or brothers come to complain to us, we'll say to them, give them as a personal favor to us, because we didn't take wives for each of them in battle. You didn't give them to them. That would have made you guilty for breaking your oath." So the men of Benjamin did this. They took wives for themselves from the girls who were dancing, as many as they needed, and they carried them off. And they went back to the land of their inheritance, rebuilt the cities, and lived in them. The people of Israel then left that place. Each man returned to his tribe and family, and each man went out from there to the land he had inherited. At that time, there was no king in Israel. A man simply did whatever he thought was right. Verse 1 says that all the people of Israel answered the call to do something about the murder of the Levite's concubine by some wicked Benjamites. It also makes the point that despite the tension that existed between the 2.5 tribes of Israel who had elected to make their homes east of the Jordan River and the 9.5 tribes who had entered the promised land with Joshua and settled there just as they were supposed to do, the warriors from Gilead also responded to the call. Now, Gilead was technically a specific area occupied by the tribes of Gad and Manasseh in the Transjordan, but it was also used as a general term at times to refer to all members from those 2.5 tribes. The writer, better the editor, of the book of Judges uses the term from Dan to Beersheba to mean all of Israel. This makes the subtle point that this narrative was written after the tribe of Dan had migrated to the north of Israel and conquered the city of Laish. But because there is constant mention of the phrase, "At that time there was no king in Israel," it is also obviously making the point in relation to a time that Israel did have a king. So this was very likely written during the era of the kings, Saul, David, or Solomon. I want to reiterate that it was Hebrews from the tribe of Benjamin who wanted to homosexually gang rape the Levite man, but then accepted his concubine to somewhat assuage their perverted sexual appetites. And they were not satisfied until they killed her in the process. But I find it equally appalling that the Levite man's response to all this, which was to butcher virtually and desecrate his concubine's corpse, was apparently considered justifiable, when in fact the Levite ought to have been prosecuted for such a ghoulish dismembering of her. But such was the condition of Israel at that time. And generally throughout the period of the judges it was that way, and there's no hint of an objection to his actions. Verse 2 explains that 11 of the tribes gathered at Mitzpah. This was considered a holy convocation to engage in a kind of holy war, even though we can't really give it a holy war status. So the Hebrew words used to describe it are Kahal Ha'edah, which means the congregation of the people. And this phrase is generally reserved for a gathering of the people of Israel to worship God. Now, 400,000 armed men showed up. This is further proof of the early date of this event, even though it was not written about until maybe 300 years later. Because Israel still had a sense of unity about it. And this was a holdover from the days of Joshua. Now, as you've already learned from reading about the Shoftim, the judges of Israel, during their day, beginning with Othniel, Israel was very divided, and each tribe generally cared only for themselves. The tribal prince, the chief of Benjamin, had no doubt also received a portion of this concubine's body, in expectation that he and his tribe would want to join their brethren in punishing those men of Gibeah as just an outlaw group. But the leadership of Benjamin chose to harbor the murderers instead of siding with Israel. So, of course, they knew what was going on. The other tribes, they knew, were gathering for war. Once everyone was gathered at Mitzpah, the tribal elders of Israel asked the aggrieved Levite man to tell his story to them as a group so they could all hear it and have the same information. Not surprisingly, he lied. The Levite man told them the men of Gibeah wanted to kill him, and that was not the case at all. So things started off on pretty bad footing. Now, verse 8 is essentially the making of an oath before God by the 11 tribes. And it was that they would not return to their homes without taking proper retribution against Benjamin. Now, as an aside, what the scripture actually says that they will not return to their oel or their bait. Oel means tent, bait means a dwelling or a house. All right, made of stone or brick or wood. So again, proof of just how soon after entering Canaan this occurred, because many of Israel had not yet conquered their territories fully, many of them were still living in goatskin tents like they used during their Exodus journey, while others indeed were living in stone dwellings, very probably dwellings of the Canaanites who had formerly lived there. Now, apparently, a protracted battle with Benjamin was anticipated, because the first thing the leaders of the 11 tribes did was to agree to assign 10% of their men, their army, the task of establishing a supply line to those who were going to do the fighting. Benjamin was already known as among the very best, the most fierce, stubborn warriors of Israel. And the 11 tribes were not about to take him for granted just because of the large advantage of numbers that they enjoyed. But Benjamin had another advantage that we're going to explore shortly. Terrain. Now, without doubt, this grand meeting at Mitzpah was but a formality, as they would never have mustered their armies and marched them there if it was only to have a discussion and go home. Okay, their collective minds were made up before they ever left home. But since the goal was to punish the guilty, well, then the next thing that happened was that runners were sent to various of the clan leaders of Benjamin with a message to hand over those men of Gibeah for proper justice, execution in this case. But instead, Benjamin refused either to invoke justice on their own, as they should have, since these men of Gibeah did what was patently against the laws of the Torah and they committed a capital crime, nor would they allow the 11 tribes to do it for them. Instead, they chose to fight against their brethren on behalf of these degenerates for no other reason than these degenerates also happened to be Benjamites. So here we see another side to tribalism. And a little later on in this story, yet another decision is going to be made to illustrate that ancient tribal mindset. It is that above all, above everything, tribes remain loyal to themselves. And they do not easily accept outside interference, even from a brother tribe. And although tribes, they're always, by the way, divided up into clans, would regularly have blood feuds going on amongst themselves, God forbid an outsider would want to inject their influence into the matter. Just watch the evening news about all the goings on in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and Iraq and Jordan, Syria, other places in the Orient where tribalism still rules, and you're going to see this exact pattern dominating to this very day. It is nigh on to impossible, I think, for Westerners to wrap our minds around this foundational, what, cultural aspect of the Middle East. But we can learn about it simply by proper study of the Bible, because it was the same then as it is now. Understand. It is Islam's intent to return the entire globe to tribal governance. So if you still think it's wise to consider peace through appeasement with Islam, you might want to realize the end result of this first. Benjamin gathered their fighting men together for war. 26,000 of them. Now remember, a fighting man was generally regarded to be somebody from around 20 years of age to around 50. Those younger and older men of Benjamin were not counted among the 26,000. So verse 14 begins with unfortunately, a poor translation in our complete Jewish Bibles. It says that there the people of Benjamin gathered and went to Gibeah to fight. What it says in Hebrew is that the Ben, B-E-N, of Benjamin gathered and went to Gibeah to fight. In this passage, just before, it also alludes to the Ben, B-E-N, of Israel. See, the thing is that while it certainly makes sense just the way it is, this is actually just an expression used in this context, saying the children of Benjamin didn't mean all the people of Benjamin, nor did it merely mean sons, nor certainly did it mean non-adults. Rather, the idea is that these are the representatives of Benjamin, or earlier representatives of Israel. They didn't constitute all. In fact, it is an endearing saying, meaning that they're doing a service on behalf of their tribe or their nation. Now, in addition to the 26,000 fighters of Benjamin, were 700 Benjamite men of the city of Gibeah, many of who would have been the criminals who killed that concubine, by the way. They gave him a combined total of 26,700 soldiers. The additional reference to the 700 left-handed stone slingers were only a special group of Benjamites within that 26,700, and this is not a small thing. Those 700 stone slingers were deadly accurate, and the stronger men could sling stones that weighed up to a pound at 90 miles an hour. Now, it's helpful to notice that the 400,000 soldiers of the combined Israelite army only represented two-thirds of the size of the available army under Joshua. So there were reserve forces if needed. But Benjamin was outnumbered almost 20 to 1. So I imagine such a need for a reserve force wasn't even remotely contemplated. Now, with the battle lines and forces set and described to us, the assault began, but not before the army of Israel went up to Bethel to consult with God. Now, first, the entire army was not moved to Bethel, only the commanders. But second of all, why go to Bethel at all? What's the point? Well, there's much disagreement among scholars over this matter. However, as time goes on, evidence mounts, I think, to explain it. And it has to do with the location of the wilderness tabernacle at this time. See, when Israel first arrived in Canaan, the tabernacle was first set up at Shechem. And a while later, it got moved to Shiloh, but only briefly before it then moved on to Bethel. And after some time, it was moved back to Shiloh from Bethel, and it remained there for several hundred years. So we've arrived at the point in time in this particular story of the era when the sanctuary, and therefore the central religious authority of Israel, the priesthood, was located in Bethel. So we see in verse 18 that the main reason that they went to Bethel was to inquire about how to proceed in battle. This is something they remembered from the days of Joshua. So it says that they asked God how to proceed, and the answer to their question was Judah first. But did God actually speak audibly to somebody in this situation? No. See, it was that the Urim and Thummim, as carried and operated by the high priest, were consulted. These two sacred stones indicated God's specific will. We don't know exactly how the stones indicated the divine answer. Perhaps it was by lot, maybe one or the other of the two stones glowing or something. We just don't know. But in no way did they speak God's voice, or was any other audible means employed that is recorded. So in this story, when we see such responses, when they ask God who should go first, and they got the response, Judah go first. It's not that these are Jehovah's words. It is that this is the indicated result of the questions to the Urim and Thummim stones. So having received their answer, the army attacked Gibeah with Judah in the lead. They were slaughtered, presumably with Judah taking the brunt of all the casualties. 22,000 of the Israelite army's soldiers were killed. I mean, how could Benjamin do so much damage against such great odds? Well, for one thing, the terrain worked for them. Gibeah is located in hilly country, so that favors the defense. No matter how many soldiers Israel had available, only a small portion of them could approach the city to assault it, while the bulk of the forces waited their turn as replacements for the fallen. But no soldier is anxious to throw himself into battle over the strewn bodies of his comrades, so they skulked away defeated. The leaders of the army went back to Bethel, and they wept, and they beseeched Jehovah for the reasons why they had failed, given that they seemed to have his backing and that they had followed his instructions. They again consulted God by means of the high priest and those two stones, and they asked if they should attack once more. The answer was yes. And after regrouping, they prepared for another attack upon Gibeah. Even though it says that this occurred on the second day, it doesn't mean the day after the first battle. It simply means the second time they battled. And several days or weeks even could have passed in between the first and second battles. They are again defeated. Israel lost an additional 18,000 men. So in verse 26, we find Israel trudging back again to Bethel, tails between their legs, dismayed and confused, but not quite ready to give up. This time they took a different approach to their inquiry of God. They fasted, they offered sacrifices, and then again they asked God what they should do. And the answer was unequivocal. Unequivocal. Attack Gibeah one more time. But the Lord communicates that this time it'll be different. This time Benjamin will fall to the sword. So the Israelites were contrite before God. They now understood the repentance and humility were needed to properly approach the Creator of all things, and that numbers alone never guarantees success. So they switched tactics. And instead of a direct frontal assault upon Gibeah, they planned an ambush, much in the same mold as was used in the battle for Ai, led by Joshua. Now here we find that the war priest for Israel was none other than Phinehas, the grandson of Aaron, whose resolute action of using a spear to run through the Midianite woman and the Hebrew man who were having intercourse inside the camp of Israel, killing them both, had saved Israel from God's wrath. Phinehas's bold action, Phinehas also known as Pinchas, okay? Phinehas's bold action, when everybody else was paralyzed or just utterly dismayed and disinterested, atoned for Israel's rebellion before the Lord and ended a divine plague that had already killed 24,000 Israelites. This Phinehas is one of the more unrecognized, I think, Old Testament Bible heroes. He had taken a lead role in the war against Midian. He acted as a mediator during a time when the 2.5 tribes east of the Jordan were suspected of disunity and apostasy due to the erection of a memorial altar. Now, interestingly, like Moses, he had also been given an Egyptian name for some reason. Pe-Nehasi is the Egyptian pronunciation of his name, and it means Nubian, or more appropriate for the situation, the dark-skinned one. Just as Moses' given Egyptian name was Mose, that was later Hebraized to Moshe, then Englishized to Moses, so Pe-Nehasi in Egyptian was later Hebraized to Pe-Nahas, and we say Phinehas in English. Bottom line, Phinehas was a noticeably darker skinned man than the average olive skinned Hebrew. Well, the third attack upon Gibeah commences just like the previous two. The Benjamites assumed that since the method of assault seemed the same, they could expect the same result. And what they didn't know was that it was all a trick. And when it appeared that the Israelites were being routed, they turned and ran, and the warriors of Benjamin gave chase. Once they were a fair distance outside of Gibeah's defensive walls, a hidden company of Israelites stole into the city, captured it, and burned it. And when the Israelites who were running away saw the thick black clouds of smoke rising upward, that was the signal for them to turn around and begin attacking the Benjamites who were pursuing them. And with their city captured and then caught in a vise between two forces, the army of Benjamin was doomed. 18,000 men of Benjamin died defending Gibeah. The rest ran and tried to save their lives, but the warriors of Israel were ready for that and easily caught up to them, and they killed them. 5,000 of them fled towards the rock of Ramon. Ramon means pomegranate tree. And they were slaughtered on the road. Another 2,000 headed for the city of Gidom. They were killed. 600 more made it to the rock of Ramon, and they hid there for 4 months. And so they survived. After this, the Israeli army executed every last man, woman, child, even all of the livestock that had anything to do with Gibeah. The tribe of Benjamin lay on the verge of complete extinction. Moving on to chapter 21. Some time passed. The heat of the battle was over. The victorious Israelites had time to think over everything that had transpired here. And they fell into grief over it. They reflected on what the result of their actions meant for the future of Israel. And they repented. And even though it was Benjamin who necessitated this war by their outrageous position of defending the deranged men of Gibeah who turned to homosexuality and behaved exactly as the heathen of Sodom, and at the time it must have been seemed reasonable that just as God annihilated Sodom, that same justice upon Gibeah was in order, maybe Israel had gone a little too far. And we've talked about the issue of swearing oaths and making vows in God's name and just how dangerous of an undertaking that is. We moderns like to think otherwise, but we really don't take our oaths and vows all that seriously in general. But to the ancient, it was unthinkable to violate an oath or a vow because the consequence was probably going to be devastating and long-lasting. So making a rash oath or a vow is a doubly bad idea. But Israel now realized they had done just that before they'd even shot one arrow in anger against Benjamin. And as the Israelite force of 400,000 soldiers gathered in Mizpah in war council before heading towards Gibeah, they had made a vow. Sounded pretty good, but now it faced them with a terrible dilemma. The vow was that no one from any of the 11 tribe coalition would allow their daughter to marry a Benjamite. The problem was a mere 600 men remained out of the entire tribe of Benjamin. And with no women to bear children for them, the line of Benjamin would end. And as bad as this sounds to us, it was horrific to the mind of an ancient Hebrew that one of Jacob's sons would lose his place among the family of Hebrews was just too awful to contemplate. See, in tribal society, it's one thing for interrelated tribes to war and kill amongst themselves in order to punish or achieve dominance, but it's quite another to kill off an entire bloodline, and this was usually avoided at all costs. Well, when the victorious Israelites realized that the utter demise of Benjamin was a very real probability now, they went before God, again back up, they went to Beit El, to the tabernacle, and they wept and they asked for forgiveness as well as trying to understand why God would even allow such a thing to happen. They offered sacrifices of repentance to Yahweh. They sought a solution. And they absolutely, however, could not break their vow. A vow of refusing to give to Benjamin their daughters for marriage and childbearing. So how do they keep Benjamin from extinction? Verse 7 sums up the problem very well. How are we going to obtain wives for those who remain alive, those Benjamite men who remain alive, very few, since we've sworn by Adonai we won't let our daughters marry them? They find an answer to the problem in a very convoluted, unexpected way. And it starts with Israel's search to find out if any clan of Hebrews had failed to show up to contribute to the war effort. And it turns out that the people of the city of Jabesh Gilead, meaning the people who lived in the city of Jabesh and the territory of Gilead, which is east of the Jordan, had not answered the call. Understand, this was in violation of a much earlier and perhaps more fundamental oath. And that oath was that all Israel was united under God and under the laws of Moses, and so they were duty-bound to act together as one in a crisis. Jabesh was seen as traitors to God and to Israel. And not only that, at the time of the war council in Mizpah, an oath was sworn that the punishment For whoever did not participate in the war against Benjamin, they were to be killed. So a strike force of 12,000 from Israel was sent across the Jordan to take vengeance. Everyone was to die, except for girls of childbearing age, but who were still virgins. These girls were to be captured and brought back to Shiloh. Turns out there were about 400 of them. So a plan was forming to kill two birds with one stone, so to speak. First was to execute those people of Jabesh in order to satisfy the vow of killing everybody who refused to participate in the war. But second was to find wives for the remaining 600 men of Benjamin. Those virgin girls of Jabesh would provide a good start to remedy this problem. So we're going to back up just a bit. The 600 men were not all that remained of Benjamin. Some number of elderly, perhaps some infants, very young children remained alive. The key is that these 600 men were those of an age who were able to impregnate women. And the reason that the virgin girls of childbearing age were captured was that by being virgins, it would make them desirable as wives and would give them many years in which to bear as many children as possible to replenish the tribe. Now, I want to show you another interesting thing. In verse 11, the order is given to completely destroy every man, woman, and child of Jabesh Gilead, except those virgins we're talking about, of course. Now, what is usually translated, like on our complete Jewish Bible, as completely destroy, is in Hebrew, the word is cherem. Now, that ought to be a word that sounds familiar to you. It is in other places in the Old Testament usually translated into English as ban, B-A-N, ban. See, cherem means to destroy something for the purpose of giving it to God. Cherem is a holy war term. It indicates that since the true commander of a holy war is God himself, then the spoils of war need to go to him. But how does one give the spoils of war to God? He says, it is to be in the form of a kind of burnt offering. So the spoils must be destroyed and then burned up. In this way, it is dedicated, it is banned to God. And at the same time, the people can't partake of it because it's all been destroyed. So to the Israelites, they saw what they were about to do to the people of Jabesh Gilead as a holy endeavor. And so for them, the killing of the people was going to be made under the law of cherem. It was holy to their minds because it was carrying out an oath that they had made before God to kill all who would refuse to participate in the war against Benjamin. Now, was this a good thing before the Lord? Hardly. It was just another case of men making a rash vow, and they would rather follow through with it, no matter what the consequences to others might be, than not follow through and accept the consequences of their own sin, of breaking a vow. The 400 virgins of Jabesh were given to the lone male survivors of Benjamin, but that left them still 200 wives short. What to do? Well, they came up with another clever plan. Just gets worse, doesn't it? There was a festival to the Lord each year in Shiloh. Lots of women naturally went to it. The young girls, especially the virgins, customarily participated in it by dancing. Some leaders of the Israelites went to the leaders of the 600 remaining Benjamites and told them that if they would just go to Shiloh at this festival time and hide, then when these young virgins came to dance, they could be pounced upon and they could cart them all off for wives. The Israelites would be sure there would be no interference, and the men of Benjamin would be free to remove these girls back to their allotted territory of Benjamin. Now, what's going to happen when the fathers and other male family members of these stolen girls come to the leadership of Israel and complain about the theft of their daughters and seek justice? Well, they would be told to do the leadership a favor. This sounds like the mafia, doesn't it? It sounds like we're watching The Godfather here. And they were asked, just don't react. Don't do anything. Just let it be. Because you know what? It's all the best for Israel. Besides, they wouldn't be breaking their vow to God to not give Benjamin any daughter of Israel because their girls weren't given. They were kidnapped. So it's not their fault. This is brilliant. It's just that these fathers would make the decision not to retrieve them. Wow. I mean, it's so many, I don't, it's no wonder so many Jews become lawyers. But I want to point out something, though, that might go unnoticed. But it's important. The children born now, follow this through. The children born now to the tribe of Benjamin from here forward would be mixed. That is, the 400 women of Gilead were mostly from the tribe of Manasseh. But Gilead also consisted of some populations of Gad and Reuben. The remaining 200 women taken at Shiloh were some combination of members from the other 10 tribes. So even though the fathers of the next generation of Benjamites were generally themselves Benjamites by blood, not one mother of their children would be a Benjamite by heredity. Not one. Now, I've pointed out before that Israel is hardly a genealogically pure race with all their genes coming from Abraham. Even Jacob, before he went to Egypt, acquired probably the largest part of his family during his stay at Shechem. It happened when his sons went on a raid of revenge for the rape of their sister Dinah, and in the process, they killed all the males of Shechem, and they did what with the females? Captured them. In tribal society, those foreign females would be rapidly assimilated into their captor's tribe. The women of Shechem were Hivites, a type of Canaanite. They were not Hebrews. So the family of Jacob was mixed very early on. Then in Egypt, there was much intermarriage. And so the Torah tells us that a huge number of non-Hebrews, use the term a mixed multitude, followed Israel on their exodus. And here we see drastic action taken by Israel to save the tribe of Benjamin that resulted in all future Benjamites after the war of Gibeah being of mixed tribal blood with other Israelite tribes. No modern day Hebrew could ever possibly speak of purity of bloodlines to his own tribe, let alone going back to Abraham or Jacob. Rather, the issue is of a declared allegiance to the God of Israel, just like it is for both Gentile and Jewish believers in Messiah Yeshua. One final thing, we'll be done with the book of Judges. In the time of King Saul, you're going to find an interesting relationship between King Saul and the people of Gilead. When Ammon threatened the people of Gilead, they turned to King Saul for help. Later, it would be the men of Gilead who recovered the corpses of Saul and his sons as their corpses hung on the walls of Bethshan. Saul was of the tribe of Benjamin. So we see how and why the tribe of Benjamin had a special bond with the people of Gilead. In point of fact, they were closely related by blood. And it happened as the aftermath of this war we're reading about here, as this war against Benjamin. The final words of the book of Judges ends most appropriately with, "At that time there was no man, no king in Israel. A man simply did whatever he thought was right." You know, I truly pray that we see that just as God was showing Israel that they needed a king, so do we need a king. And his name is Yeshua. Unfortunately, we are today reliving the time of the judges. The state of Judeo-Christianity is as it was in the days of Othniel, Deborah, Samson, with every man doing what is right in our own hearts, doing deeds that seem pious and righteous outwardly, comfortable to us inwardly, but paying little heed to the actual word of God. This concludes our study on the book of Judges.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them, merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seed of Abraham Fellowship.